A number of years ago, about this time of year, I was working as director of the library at what is now called the American Jewish University. And I got a call from a man who said, "I'm a Bible-reading Christian, and I'd like to know when you guys up there at the Jewish University will be practicing the Paschal sacrifice for this year." And I said, "Excuse me, I don't know what you mean." He said, "Well, you sacrifice a lamb, don't you, for the Passover?" And I said, "Not for a couple thousand years. But we will again when the temple's rebuilt, so check back with me." Okay, I wasn't quite that flip. I explained that Judaism was a rabbinic, not a biblical tradition, and that in fact it was shaped not by what you read in the Bible nearly as much as by what the rabbis interpreted the Bible to mean, but it was certainly true that sacrifice played a very large part in classical Judaism before the destruction of the temple, and in fact, we still read about it and speak about it today, but we don't practice it, not on Mulholland Drive. But we read about it this morning, and when you ask yourself, what is this about, I want to make one suggestion. That in fact, if we understand sacrifice, we will understand why there is no peace in our world and how there one day could be. What's different between sacrificing an animal and buying one in the supermarket? The difference, as I spoke about briefly a couple of weeks ago, is when you take an animal that you have raised and you bring it to the temple, and you see it slaughtered before your eyes, you still eat the animal. But it doesn't come prepackaged in cellophane at Whole Foods. And so you have a sense that what you're doing is taking a life, and you have a relationship to that life, and you feel it. I almost want to say you haven't dehumanized the animal. But we have no relationship that way. Yeah, we know there are factory farms somewhere, but it's behind the counter. And that same phenomenon that happens with our food happens with each other. Sometimes we dehumanize just because the human mind is incapable of understanding the vastness of human suffering. And so we can understand the story of Anne Frank, but we can't understand what 6 million means. But it's not only that. We put people outside the circle of human every single day, all of us. We know there are people starving in the world. We know there are people suffering. But we somehow can't think of them as human beings because to do so seems too painful. So we drive by the guy who's sitting on the side of the road, and we deliberately don't look at him because we know that to really look at him will evoke emotions in us that we don't want to feel and that we have no place to put. So we will dehumanize him for our comfort so that we can go on. All of us do it, every day. And we don't only do it with people whose suffering we can't alleviate or won't alleviate. We do it most powerfully with our enemies. Real or imagined. For thousands of years, this is what humanity did to that mythical figure called the Jew. Jews were outside the circle of humanity. We were dehumanized. Did you ever think of what it means? That sometimes when people speak about the Shoah, they talk about how Jews were exterminated. What kind of word is that to use about a human being? A human being isn't exterminated, a human being is murdered. But you know that in order for the Nazis, and not only the Nazis, but for that matter, for medieval torturers, for thousands of years, in order for people to be able to do what they did to the Jewish people, they had to put them outside the circle of human beings. Because it is so hard for one human being to do this to another. You know that at the beginning of medical school, what do you have to do to medical students in order to get them to dissect a corpse? You have to systematically desensitize them. Because it somehow goes against the grain to cut up a human being. And yet, of course, in order to heal, you have to do it. But that same mechanism that there is used for healing, elsewhere is used for hurting. How do you blow up a bus full of children? The only way you do it is if previously you've decided that these aren't really human beings. They have human shape. They act like human beings, but they're not really human. And by the way, so that we don't escape the indictment that in fact surrounds the globe, we do the same thing to our enemies. We don't want to hear human stories of Palestinian suffering because it makes them human. And it is much easier to have an enemy that's not human. You don't have to think about the pain of the other, because once you do, you can't be comfortable again. And so what you get is, when you speak about someone's enemy, whether it is a Jew or a Palestinian or an Indian or a Kashmiri or a Pakistani, whatever it is, you will get the following. Yes, they're human, but they did it to themselves, but it's their fault, but if they hadn't done this first. The but comes in so quickly that the human never registers. And yet, the greatest threat to human survival is the inability to think of people outside our own circle as human. I don't know how many of you were here when Marilyn Berger came to the library breakfast last year and talked about her book about Rick Hodes. Rick Hodes is a doctor. I'll take a little bit of ethnic chauvinistic pride, say a Jewish doctor from New York, who is essentially the doctor to the helpless of the world. He spends much of his time in Rwanda and elsewhere curing people who are otherwise would never see a doctor in their lives. When Mother Teresa has particularly difficult cases, she calls on Rick Hodes. He spends his entire life curing people. That's what he does. And occasionally he comes to the United States to raise a little bit of money so he can go back and continue. So she decides she's going to write a book about him. Marilyn Berger herself was a reporter. She was married to Don Hewitt, who created 60 Minutes. As she starts to write the book, her husband contracts cancer. This is what happens. She goes to Rick Hodes' clinic in Rwanda, and on the way to the clinic, she sees a child by the side of the road. He's all bent over. His spine is curved. There's something about him that draws her. So she says, come with me. I'm going to a clinic where there's a doctor who can help you. She goes to the clinic. He said, this child needs an operation. They get him an operation. They straighten out his spine. He says to Marilyn Berger, you know, this kid was within months of his spine collapsing on itself. You saved his life. She goes back to the United States. Rick Hodes writes her that he's coming to the United States for a fundraising tour. She says, you know what? If you still are in touch with that little boy, bring him. I would love to see him. I'd love to give him the chance to see the United States. He brings him. She falls in love with him. In the meantime, her husband is dying. She feels bereft. She adopts him. He comes to live with her. Now, she has to get him into school. She takes him to the head of the school board for testing. They test him. He has an IQ of 178. The head of the school board says, this is the brightest child we have ever tested. Now, if that surprises you the way it surprised me, all I can say is, why? Why wouldn't a kid who's dying by the roadside in Rwanda be just as likely to be brilliant as a kid that's raised in Scarsdale. He's a human being. But we automatically, in our minds, put people outside the circle. It's only when we meet them, or we hear their stories, or we look them in the face, that we realize there's a human being there. That's why sacrifice was so much more powerful. Because when you see death of somebody that's real, it's completely different. We have, neurologists have just discovered, a remarkable thing in human beings called mirror neurons. And this is what mirror neurons have. By the way, yours are firing right now, and I'll tell you how. Mirror neurons are neurons in your brain that when you see someone express some kind of emotion, therefore their neurons are firing, sadness, happiness, or do something in particular. Strangely enough, neurologists have found that some of the neurons in your brain fire as well. So the neurons in your brain that fire when you weep, when you see someone else weeping, some of them fire for you. It's the source of human empathy. We literally mirror what we see. It's an amazing thing. It's one of the reasons why human beings are such an imitative species. We grow up and we imitate what we see because we have these mirror neurons. That means that there is really a Yetzer HaTov. The rabbis were right. There's a good instinct in us that automatically sympathizes and empathizes with other people and what they're going through. But you know, you can cover the mirror. You can obscure the image of another person. And usually you do it when you want to cause them harm. And that's why the first lesson of the Bible is the most important. One of the best known passages of rabbinic literature is Kol HaMekayem Nefesh Achad Ki'ilu Kiyem Olam Malei. Somebody who saves a single life or destroys a single life, it's as if they saved or destroyed an entire world. The close of the Mishnah was 200 CE, so this passage is a couple thousand years old. But what you may not know is where the passage comes from. It's not just the rabbis weren't just talking one day and said, you know what, you save a single life, you save everybody. No, it is embedded in a specific warning. It's part of what you're supposed to say to witnesses in a capital case. It's in Mishnah Sanhedrin. It's about the court. When someone's about to testify in a capital case, which means they're about to testify to something that could lead to capital punishment, you have to say to them, remember, every human life is precious. If you save a single life, it's like saving a world. That's why God made one person at the beginning of the world, to tell you that one person can generate a whole world. So if you destroy a life, you destroy a world. If you save a life, you save a world. And while you still have to testify if you saw something, don't be under any illusions that that person that you're testifying against is a world. Now understand what this means. There is no one that we tend more to dehumanize than somebody who's a murderer. And what are they saying? You're about to testify against somebody who may be a murderer, but understand, that's still an entire world. That's still a human being. Don't dehumanize him, even if you have to give testimony that will send him to his death. It's a hard lesson to think of murderers as human beings. But it is the first lesson in the Torah. God creates one person to let you know that there's no such thing as a person that isn't a person. Why is there no peace? Because this is an easily ignored lesson. When will there be peace? When we understand that the very first lesson of the Torah is still the most important. Shabbat Shalom.